Our final topic is a discussion of single-payer health care and single-payer health care plans. This is would be defined often as where a single entity collects fees and then pays for the health care. But the delivery of care, this is where you got to keep this clear. You're collecting the fees, somebody's paying for it, but somebody else delivers the care. That's what a single payer plan is. The delivery of that care could be by private, public, or some coordination of public and private providers and hospitals. Typically, everyone is covered into this single plan by the same plan, which covers some predetermined services. And often, since this is a government, these services are paid for by taxes. Healthcare providers and hospitals, as I've said, can be independent. So think Medicare. If you want to know what a single payer is, the government collects taxes and pays it, and everybody who wants to get involved in being providers can be. That is a single payer system, for example. Or they can be employees of a single payer, such as the government. So in that situation, if you have somebody collecting the fees as a government, and then the government is also paying the providers, that is more of a socialized medicine kind of description, much what has England has, but we also have in the United States. If you think about the VA system or our military system. All right, so often the insured can acquire, if you are in a single payer system, you might also acquire further coverages outside of that system from private sources as well. It appears to me that worldwide experience demonstrates lower costs and more control of prices in single payer systems, but there are trade-offs. As I mentioned before, governments can squeeze the prices to make providers and consumers perhaps unhappy with what they're getting or delay access. And this can result in the common, and it also can be the result of efforts by politicians who inevitably want to stay in business and will promise reduced taxes and giving less money to run the system. So to discuss single payer health care tonight is Julie Taylor and Dr. Jennifer Perkins. Which one of you all wanted to go first? Julie?
I think I'm
going to
go.
Jennifer Perkins. Thank you, Jennifer.
So my name is Jennifer Perkins. I'm a family physician from at South Central Foundation here in Anchorage. I'm a relatively new transplant to Alaska, but a longtime single-payer advocate, which is what I'm going to talk about. So I'm honored to be on the stage for the final presentation. I think it's been an incredible series so far, and I'm definitely overjoyed to be able to actually talk about solutions. Labeled the solution in plain sight, single payer addresses the three pillars of healthcare reform that were mentioned previously. So it actually works on ensuring access, ensuring quality, and then also containing costs. So why? I'm just going to do this briefly. As we learned over the last several months, our healthcare spending is reaching a crisis point. High costs lead to significant financial burden to individuals and families, trouble paying medical bills for both the uninsured and the insured, leads to stress, delayed care, as was mentioned previously in the comment, financial instability as people burn through savings and assets, even bankruptcy. Small, medium-sized businesses flounder under the weight of the costs deemed by Forbes magazine as the most severe problem facing small businesses today. High costs lead to wage stagnation, decreased growth, decreased competitiveness on the international stage, and then people die from lack of insurance. We made the decision, and a lot of these points have been made already, but we made the decision as a country not to let people die outside of our hospital doors. Now we're stuck in this purgatory of providing end-stage emergent care at high costs and failing to provide the low-cost preventative care that improves quality of life, productivity, security, and better overall health outcomes. All right, I'll stop. So what is single payer? There are a couple slight different nuances from what had first just been described. Single payer is simply one publicly funded plan. That's all it means. There's so many variations to what that looks like. I'm going to describe a system that is most consistent with the proposed legislation in both the House and the Senate currently. And that's at the federal level. Everyone is covered simply by residing in the U.S. You have free choice of provider because all of the physicians are in network. The plan is comprehensive, so all hospital care, all outpatient care, both primary and specialty, your dental care, your vision, your mental health, and then there's some differences between the two plans about long-term health care, but that's also discussed. So this is a publicly funded plan, as was mentioned, but privately delivered, meaning hospitals and clinics would still be privately owned. So physicians would either be salaried, like I am, or they would participate in a private practice. So I know it sounds too good to be true. How do we pay for it? It's the big question, the elephant in the room. So cost containment is a big piece of the viability of the system. The single payer would be able to negotiate and standardize prices for both drugs and devices, as well as services. There is massive administrative waste, up to 30% with private insurers compared to the 3-4% for Medicare. Through simplified billing to one payer, the estimated savings is over $500 billion a year. Taiwan slashed their administrative cost to less than 2% when they went to a single payer system. And they do have an integrated medical record, which has really simplified the billing, which has probably led to that difference. So also we could roll in the current public funding that we have. We're already paying about $6,500 per capita on a federal level, which is only 2/3 of healthcare expenditures, by the way. The rest is out-of-pocket costs. So we're already paying for a single-payer system. We're just not getting it right now. Many countries pay a lot less than that for their total health care per capita. Finally, the remaining cost would likely, any sort of deficit in the remaining cost would be paid for by a payroll tax, likely. So there's an economist from UMass, Friedman, who estimated that 95% of people would still come out ahead financially despite that payroll tax, just because it would eliminate deductibles, copays, all the other things that we pay for our healthcare. Only 5% of the highest level earners would be paying more into the system. So of course there's many details that we need to iron out. We are an incredibly resourced country, both financially and intellectually. We just need the commitment to proceed. One day I really hope to think of healthcare like fire or police protection. An essential element of our community that allows us to thrive. I moved to Alaska to work for the closest thing that I could find to a single-payer system. It's not. It's got many payers. But from my perspective as a provider, all of my customers, that's what we call them at South Central, not patients, but all of them have equal access to care. I'm actually separated from the billing, so it takes out all of that murky fee-for-service stuff. I'm salaried. And I was actually told just to do what's the best for my patients. And it feels good. It allows me to focus on the medicine. So I remember being really frustrated as a resident with one of my most heartbreaking patients, actually. I gave her cancer diagnosis. And she started her cancer treatment. She had a partial resection of her lung. And then she didn't do the chemo. And I couldn't ever quite understand why she didn't do that. And then she wouldn't show up for appointments all the time, and she sometimes picked up her inhalers and she sometimes didn't. And much later on, I found out that, you know, for each one of those appointments that she missed, it was because she had to choose whether she was going to buy groceries or pay her heating bill versus paying the $50 copay to see me. So compare this to now, when I have to walk into the room with a new diagnosis of diabetes. And I go there armed with the knowledge that I am going to be followed by the diabetes educator, who is going to be delivering the medications provided by our integrated pharmacist at no cost to my customer, knowing that they're leaving my clinic with the medicines that they need in order to treat their disease, the information of how to do it, and that my team will follow up with them to address any stumbling blocks that they have when they get home. So I just don't understand why we all can't have that. Why can't we have access to that quality of care? So thanks so much for your attention. I hope that clarifies my stance on single payer, and I look forward to your questions.
Julie, save us.
Reminded me of Martin Luther. I have a dream. And I would have that dream too. And to be honest with you, if we could have that, I'm all in. I've been in healthcare over 30 years. I am a nurse turned administrator and have grown up in the front lines of healthcare. And as much as I'd like to see that happen, I've seen too many things along the way that get in front of that actually happening, and much of which we discussed tonight. So in theory, single payer, it would be great. One of the systems I've always said sounded great would be Kaiser, because they looked at hospitals as cost centers, not revenue centers. At the end of the day, though, when you're really parsing it out, first of all, you're going to count on the federal government to be your agent. I can tell you as a hospital administrator, that is not a fun job. That might be inexpensive on the side you're describing, but we add more resources on the inside just to track data and handle all the forms and the requirements. They are a very cumbersome organization to work with. When you look at the single payer system, you know, outside of that context, you also would have the ability to skip the line. So in my mind, it really doesn't change it still becomes tiered. It's still a tiered system, I guess is what I'm trying to say. If you are able to buy another insurance plan and move yourself up on the line, that's great, and those with lesser resources are still left behind. And based on the information I've heard from other countries, the waits, in Canada in particular, the waits for care can be 6 to 12 months. And as we look at it, I think we need access now, not later. So if you could have a system where you were able to connect them that quickly in the real world, I think that would be fabulous. I've just not seen any other place other than that actually happens. The other thing I would be concerned about is, you know, where does the money come for innovation? And is there going to be a commitment to that and making sure that we're really on the outside as opposed to being a public utility? Healthcare is very personal and it's very behavior driven. And we have to make sure that we have enough support in place to make sure that we're changing behavior. As you heard me say earlier, 75% of our healthcare costs are tied to negative healthcare behaviors. How many of you in the room eat your vegetables every day? Right, okay. How many of you cut sugar and wheat out of your diet and exercise? Right, okay. So, I mean, I'm just saying, it is bigger than that. So we have to have a system that is comprehensive, as they do. They have a beautiful system. I would absolutely applaud them for what they've been able to accomplish. But to wrap that into a larger context for the state, I think would be very, very hard. We don't have those same resources. I have patients that stay in the hospital for weeks on end because we don't have enough skilled nursing beds. I have patients that die in the hospital because we don't have hospice. And primary care, as I mentioned earlier, is in short supply, and I have patients in our ICU with an abscessed tooth that went septic. So those are the kind of things that we would have to address and make sure we've got our arms around before we could get into the dream, which I would agree would be wonderful.
All right. Thank you.
And so to start with, like we did before, are there questions among the panelists before we go to questions from the audience? Anybody have anything?
I guess, go for it.
No.
I have a couple questions. I guess one is, you know, I agree that dream is fantastic, but, you know, in the emergency department in Mattsu, we see about 20% are Native patients and don't have any really way to care coordinate among that. What are you guys doing to kind of broaden without that system? And then how do we transfer from what we have, like Julie says, to what that dream is? Like, how do you see us getting there?
I just missed the first part of the question, as far as coordination of care.
Yeah, so my question is with coordination of care within the state, what are you guys doing for coordination of care outside of the Native system? Because there's a lot of use outside the Native system.
Yeah.
And how does that, I mean, so we get into travel, we get into states, like if we did this for our state, what is that, you know, there's always travel. Like, how do you make sure that group is contained?
Yeah. Well, so I think the easier question, right? So, because I can't speak for South Central or for the IHS, I'm also new to that system. So, primarily, what I'm talking about is a single payer system. So, this I think works obviously with a larger pool, right? So, whether a single payer system could work in Alaska is something that we would all have to wrap our, you know, like that would take a lot more work. I think that where the majority of the cost savings come, right, are from having this huge pool and this and being able to contain the costs on a national federal level. And as far as the coordination of care piece, absolutely essential, right? Like, and I think that through whether it would be an Alaska Healthcare Authority or whether it would be through an Alaska single payer system, if we had a one medical record or one sort of some sort of technology where we could see, you know, our the imaging that the person received in your ER so that we don't repeat it or go through, you know, 2 days waiting in order to get the records. I think there's definitely a lot of, once again, you have to start to get kind of dig into the nitty-gritty, like what are we working with and how can we best fix it. As far as how do I see us getting there, there's proposals within the Sanders bill that suggest that we would start doing this gradation of buying into Medicare, and so it would be 4 years once the legislation was accepted, and then you know, the age limit would go down to 55 with people having the option to buy in, and then down to 45 and 35, and then everybody would be in. In the Conyers bill, it would be a much faster rollout within a year. And granted, Taiwan is a much smaller country, but they managed to do it in a year. I don't think it would necessarily be easy, and I know we watched the rollout of the ACA, and that did not make anybody feel confident in the government's ability to do it. But just also compare that to the fact that when Medicaid was accepted in the 60s, they were actually able to do that in 1 year.
So, I'm a veteran, and so I've been through the VA system when I didn't have private health care, and I can tell you that what you see on the news is absolutely true, that veterans die because they're in a wait for care, or that they are given the runaround for care as well. So if that's the single payer system that we're supposed to buy into, I have to say no thank you. And also, and some follow-up questions here, I like the idea of consolidating pools, which I think we've all sort of talked about, but why not let businesses like the Alaska Native Corporations are allowed to do buy into the federal Premier Blue Cross Blue Shield pool? So we just create one massive pool for the entire country that's still private. Maybe that's something to think about. And then also, my biggest problem is that you see how our government functions with shutdowns and with our own government in Alaska, where we can't come to a budget each year, where we're running out of money. I don't understand how people that want a single payer system will put the trust and faith of your own health care into politicians that can't even really pass bills these days. I know that's all three loaded questions. But I really believe in this, especially being in the VA system. It's a terrible, terrible system, and they should abolish it and just let veterans go to wherever they want to go to, and then they have to, that payer has to accept some form of payment.
All three loaded questions, all three very good questions. So I'll take
I even have more than that, because like the Alaska Natives, their whole health system, they just don't take federal money. They also accept private payers as well. So if you really wanted to have a true single payer system over at the Alaska Native system, why not accept private money?
Well, first of all, I don't think that there's anybody over there that says that we need to have a true single payer system. I think that we need to have a true single payer system on a federal level. Yeah. Let me just clarify that. It's to address the VA. So the VA is actually socialized healthcare, so it's a little bit different than the single payer system that we're proposing, meaning that the physicians are salaried, all the hospitals are owned, And the funding, you know, the funding is definitely compromised. There's also different qualities of care at the different VAs across the country. So where I trained at our VA in Madison, Wisconsin, actually the care was pretty exceptional, and outcomes were quite good. And so there, in order to answer your question, that's not exactly the single payer system that we're looking at. To answer the question about wait times, so we often compare ourselves to Canada because it's really close, but there are some ways in which the system that I'm talking about here would be comparable. There's also many other single payer systems, or at least universal healthcare systems. Holland, for example, is also kind of built on a similar model, and yet the wait times for elective, and I'm assuming you're talking about elective procedures like knees and hips, they're actually closer to 2 to 3 weeks, which is not that far away from where we are. And so granted, once again, it's a slightly smaller country, but there are many ways out there and many models out there of doing it really well, and wait times across the board actually for most of these countries with a universal healthcare system are actually pretty comparable to our own. Okay, what was the other one?
It's okay, I don't want to make you feel like I'm doing rapid fire.
No, insurance pool. I really want to address that one too, because, I think the other big piece about this this puzzle here is we've talked about the problems quite a bit, right? And I've heard it stated from different speakers along the way, it's like we keep trying to put these ridiculous band-aids on these huge holes, right? And so this is a patchwork system, and these patchwork fixes are not gonna help, right? Like, we need to really make a commitment that we're gonna change this thing and do it. Like, the ACA was a great idea as far as, like, we need to get, you know, something universal, but until we control industry, until we control the insurance companies, until we control the drug-making companies, until we control the medical device companies,
that's why I mean, like, buying into the federal Blue Cross Blue Shield, everybody would then be into the same system.
30% of administrative costs, right? So you're paying people to tell you that we're not going to pay your claim. You know what? That was great. I'm sorry.
But I would pay my taxes for a bureaucrat to tell me that they're not going to pay my claim.
But they will pay your claim. You'll have complete access to
Dr.
care.
Dr. Townsend.
You know, actually, prior to preparing for this session and thinking about the single-payer system, I would have been like Julian said, I'm all for it in principle. But I've only lived in Alaska about 2 years, I actually have a concern, and you can tell me why I shouldn't be concerned. Right now, the closest thing we have to a single-payer is Medicare, you're correct. And in Alaska, the reimbursement rates, they're 120, by the way, our Medicare rates are 125% of the national rates. But it's very clear that those rates are not adequate to provide care for, particularly primary care for Medicare patients. Everyone knows that there's a problem providing primary care.
Only in some places. So in Fairbanks, that isn't an issue. So it is an issue in Anchorage, and it is an issue in Matsu, but it isn't an issue everywhere. So the markets are quite different.
But my concern is, I think there's some agreement that one of the things that we've done in Alaska, one of the reasons why we have higher costs is we paid for better access. And if we ended up with a national system, would that national system, like as Medicare does, end up with, okay, Alaska gets a little better deal, but still a problem attracting, with a single national rate, attracting providers to Alaska?
Okay, I think there's two parts to that question, and please.
Go ahead.
Okay. I think there's two parts of that question. As far as attracting physicians, I think I'm a good person to speak to that because I came up here so that I could work in a system that I thought was equitable and good. It was the best system I could find with good support. But as far as Medicare, so Medicare is in some way a single-payer system, right? But the systems that we're looking at, are improved Medicare. There are so many problems with Medicare, right? And there are, like, the fact that they can't negotiate for drug prices is a huge one, right? And this is the problem. This is the part of your question that I did not address. It's like, how can we trust the government to run our healthcare system when they can't do anything right now? I mean, it's so depressing, right? But then at the same time, you look at the fact that, you know, all of the people that do have federally funded insurance are still able to get to the doctor. They're still getting their bills paid. There are protections in place, right? So it does, it can work. And I think we would need to definitely make sure the safeties are in place to protect patients and to protect citizens. But do we really want to continue? I might be getting tangential here, but do we really want the insurance companies making those decisions for us instead, right? Do we really want industry directing us when their only motivation is actually to turn a profit?
I wanted to make two really quick comments. I mean, I think the most important thing that's been said the whole night is when you said we're spending for universal health care, but we're not getting it. Yeah. You know, 50% of emergency care is in the ED, and we're not getting that. So I think that that's huge. I think that one of my concerns with the bills that are coming out, and what you mentioned, you know, we can't afford Medicare, or it doesn't cover costs. When an average medical student leaves with $250,000 worth of debt, and on top of it, they have to pay huge points in malpractice, that bill doesn't address either of those things. And when you have single-payer systems, it addresses a lot of that. So you have a tort reform system, much like you have in the native system, and we have argued on a federal legislative basis that emergency care, if that's really going to be federally mandated, that that's covered under the same tort system that happens with the native system as well as the VA system, and have not been able to get that legislation moved at all. If we're going to have a universal health care, then let's take off some of these other burdens to get providers to do it so we can drop rates. They're not paying for these other things.
But there's a difference between single payer and universal health care. Universal health care can have many different payers. Single payer is one, the government.
Ralph, I was going to ask you a question. As the economist, I wonder if you know a number. I was quoted once that the cost per Native beneficiary in the state of Alaska is roughly $60,000. Have you heard that number? Have you familiar with that number?
I actually heard that. I'd actually be curious to see it because I.
It was interesting. So, but my other question laid up to that: do we know what the cost per beneficiary is now in Alaska? No, I didn't mean it that way. That wasn't my context.
That is horrible to say out loud.
Okay.
Doug,
well.
Come on, Doug.
It's okay. I'm trying to use an equation. I take it.
Given the position of authority, you're to say that out loud in the public forum to all these people is slander.
I apologize. I did not intend that. Please forgive me. I was trying to get to the point of the question of cost per beneficiary. So throw that number out. Forget you heard it. It's wrong. Cost per beneficiary in the state of Alaska. Do you know that number by chance?
I gathered the numbers for the HCA, and I can tell you, for example, for Medicaid, we're covering, there's a slight problem because we have data on enrollees as opposed to beneficiaries in the private, and so you've got to estimate how many family members are in, so these are not perfect. But for Medicaid, the cost per enrollee is a little over $10,000. For retirees, it's a little over $12,000. That retiree figure is, I think, a little bit misleading because retirees do get federal benefits on top of it, and I think this is only state figures, in my opinion. For the university and for the state system, it's about 19,000. So the state employees and the university are all running about the same, about 19,000. And then for local, and this is the reason why the study said there's some low-hanging fruit in local. For local, it's a little higher in the $22,000 to $23,000 per estimated covered person, because you don't. The problem with private insurance is that you know how many employees you have. It's easy to get that information. The number of people that are covered as dependents is a little harder to get, so you have to estimate it.
Right.
But this tries to get to an apples-to-apples comparison between Medicaid and private. And I believe that the state figures of $18,000 or $19,000 would be pretty comparable for what's being paid for Primera and Aetna in the private sector, because it's very similar coverage and very similar pools.
Right, and so how does that compare to the lower 48 cost per beneficiary? Have you heard those numbers?
Yeah. I don't recall the overall numbers. I've just seen the numbers disaggregated on the amount we're spending on physicians and hospitals. So, and you have an idea where those numbers are.
I'm trying to back into it, and again, forgive my comment about the number. I pulled that out of the air. But when we're talking about going to Holland and being able to use that system, it was my understanding that maybe 30-ish, 40% of their taxes go towards healthcare. Have you heard that? Or what number that they might be spending to be able to achieve that?
I'm not gonna.
Because I love the idea. I guess that's my point, is that how can you pay into a system so that you can actually support that? So I didn't know if there was any numbers that would help us understand what the cost
of. Well, remember, Julie, when you compare, I mean, it's true, the European countries in general have higher national taxes in particular. And when you consider the fact that a big chunk of ours is going to defense and much less of theirs is going to defense, obviously the taxes they're spending on social programs in collectively is much higher. But they are, after all, providing behavioral health coverage at a much higher level than social support services, income maintenance programs, which are all healthcare related, I mean, have impacts on healthcare. So they're very different systems, and I think it's hard to come, but there's no question that European societies are paying for a more elaborate social safety net than we're willing to pay for in the U.S.
But I think the tricky part is we do pay, we just aren't paying with any kind of fair formula that we've all agreed to. So, you know, some people are paying a lot. I mean, so just looking at your numbers there's some variation there, but that's what the employer is paying for those enrollees. The individuals, you know, some of them are paying towards their premium, some of them aren't at all. Then you compare that to that self-employed person who's paying $3,000 a month compared to it. So it's very uneven who's paying what. And the aggregate amount that we're putting forward is pretty enormous, but it's just being contributed to kind of randomly. So I think that's the real key for me is, how could you actually create a system where, a tax at least has some kind of formula that we've agreed to.
Yeah, what I'm hearing you say, and what I don't think everybody realizes, is we're paying more than everybody else per capita. We have lower taxes. So all of us are paying more for more without taxes.
Right.
I mean, we're paying more. It doesn't matter what you call it, you know, and where it's coming from. And then the question is, what's the most equitable way of doing things?
So the point.
And others are health is getting better than ours is. I want to point that out. Okay, sorry.
So the point I was trying to make is that if we invest on the front end, and we do it right the first time, like South Central Foundation has done, the investment has gone into primary care, and they have won awards for that because they do it right the first time. They invest in the right places so that in the long term you get a better outcome. You know, that is the investment that you need to make. So where is that math that helps us figure out how to do it right the first time? As I said, I had a $1 million patient in the ICU from an abscess tube. It's ridiculous.
And I think so. I also think that you're talking about this earlier. I think so. Not only are we seeing the money coming out of our pockets in order to pay for these healthcare expenses, but also we're missing all of the raises that would have happened over the last decade, really, and probably even longer than that. And people don't see those costs. And so somehow it's a matter of putting up that mirror so people can see how much they're giving up already. I mean, most people really think they love their healthcare until they have to use it, right? So if you're only paying, $20 or $50 a month as a single person for your premium, and then all of a sudden you get sick and you realize that your coverage is actually horrible and that you're paying these huge, out-of-pocket costs for it, then you end up at forums like this and you are outraged, right? But until you have to use it, you don't necessarily know how bad the system is.
It seems to me, again, that I keep hearing is that we're all trying to figure out ways to change the system. And you either have the payers in charge, where the government's making all the decisions, or the way we have it in a fee-for-service thing, where the providers and hospitals are driving the costs and everything. It's one or the other, and there's pros and cons in each one. So we really haven't seemed to address some big issue here.
And solved it.
It keeps coming back to me that at least in our current system, which is primarily has been fee-for-service, and in the fee-for-service model, someone comes to me with a problem. I give them some treatment. They don't get better. I've made some money. They go back home. They come back not any better. I get paid again. They go home. They go to the emergency room. Emergency room gets paid again. Then they get admitted to the hospital for this problem. There's no incentive to stay keep people well in a fee-for-service model.
And that goes back to personal responsibility as well.
Kind of. I mean,
sort of. So,
yeah, I mean, if you continue to go back for the same problem to different areas, that's not you being a bad doctor or them being a bad ER doc. It's them not taking care of their
Mr. Fogel, everybody in the world is the same. They keep prices down. Everybody's the same. Humans in Alaska are no different. We use the same amount of health care as everybody else. So I don't think that solves the problem. Let me continue this. So it seems like our big problem is this fee-for-service issue to me. And how do we move from that? And the problem then becomes political. We aren't ready for that yet. And until we all scream loud enough, things aren't going to change. Ralph, you were talking to me before the program about don't think we're ready to this. And I thought you did a good job.
Can I say two things? I mean, one, in terms of talking about Alaska's current healthcare problems, and the facts are pretty straightforward. We pay a lot more for about the same usage level as the rest of the U.S.
Right.
The single payer is not going to work in Alaska because there's lots of federal payers, and if they're not in, it's not a single payer system. And quite honestly, at the federal level, if you ran a referendum, I might vote for it. I can tell you that my father, who was on Medicare, would not have voted for it. And I can tell you most Medicare patients oppose a single payer system. People in most employer systems, the AARP was a major advocate against the ACA because it cut benefits for the elderly just a little. So I think politically getting there in our combination of Medicare, military, and private employers, where there are many people who are satisfied with care, is such a large obstacle. I'll be honest, I could vote for it, but I don't think it's going to happen in our lifetime. But the second issue you raise about, what is the issue that prevents us from getting there? Remember that patients value a lot of aspects of the relationship with their physician. I grew up in a rural area in Maine, and I'm dating myself a little, but 50 years ago, or a little more than that, when I was a kid, when we went to the doctor's office, it was straightforward. We waited for 4 hours. Now, you laugh about that, but people today, if you said that that's what we've got to go to save some costs, people would say, well, no, right? The second thing, I've been in managed care systems. I've been in managed care systems that provided superb care. I've been in managed care systems that were disastrous. And they officially had continuity of care. They had this complicated computer system. One day I read what was in their complicated computer system. It was not what I told the providers, to be honest. And people who have been in managed care systems have that attitude that what they want is a certain quality of care that is incentivized by fee-for-service for many of the people in the United States. And that's also true in Alaska. And that gets to the question that Thea pointed out. We could afford to do that when we had a lot of money. Are we at a point where we'd say, actually, we need to provide care in more in ways that provide the health outcomes without necessarily doing all the things that the patients value in terms of the patient experience, because there are some trade-offs there. The ability to call a urologist and say, I want to be treated for a UTI, I mean, that is part of what people see as the convenience of the current system. And it is, I see that as being the tension that underlies not only Alaska, but much of the US.
All right, so let's continue to be philosophical for just a second. So we're not going to get there politically. That's what I heard.
I don't think so.
our costs are 18% in the national level of our gross national product and rising. I don't know what it is in Alaska. For every cent that keeps going, our percentage that goes up, that has less money we can spend on other things. Where is this end? What's the end game politically then?
First of all, I mean, you have seen, again, in the lower 48, where larger populations, larger service units, you do see capitated systems, and they have lots of names. And those systems do provide a more appropriate mix of services. And I think you're going to see more of that in the lower 48. The difficulty for Alaska is that it will be a struggle for us to get big enough pools to create those. Okay.
Which has been a problem ever since I've been up here. We just don't have enough population base. We don't have enough industry base. We just can't do the things
we need to do. Okay, but just to note, we've now used that argument on both sides, that because we're small, we have to have a billion small pools, but we're not big enough to have one. I mean, I think that's a little bit, I mean, I think there's another way to look at it, which is we have 700,000 people here. That's really not that many. And even if you took out our tribal members, even if you just took Anchorage, you know, there's 300,000 people here. Really? Like, there's no economy. You just said you need 100,000 members. I mean, there's no economy of scale anywhere. If anywhere there should be one, it's in Anchorage. And I think Anchorage is actually just my kind of analysis of our situation. Anchorage is kind of the biggest problem. Like, when you get to these smaller, more captive places, there is more integration. But here, we do have a total free-for-all going on. And I just wonder, really, there's no room to maneuver, either politically or structurally? It's hard for me to buy that. I mean, I agree that you're right. Get Medicare for all, but I mean, I agree.
I got a very concrete economist telling me, you're crazy, Dr.
I mean, it's just one economist. That's right.
I'm sure you can hire an economist with a different opinion. Yeah.
We should take some of their questions.
Reality and... All right, Dr. Perkins, you had a question.
No, there were just a couple of things that I wanted to comment on. First of all, actually, most people value Medicare very, very highly.
Sure.
Across national polls. And I know that you mentioned before, we actually, in Alaska, that we reimburse higher for Medicare. That's not true. Actually, we're one of the lowest reimbursers for Medicare here in the state of Alaska.
Yes,
no?
That's true. What you're saying is true.
Medicaid
is higher here.
Medicaid is higher, and that is not the case in most parts of the country.
Let's clear this up. Medicare and Medicaid are reimbursed differently.
Yeah,
and Medicare, so clear this up. Let's get it clear.
So in most of the lower 48, Medicaid reimburses at a lower rate than Medicare.
Exactly.
Here, Medicaid reimburses, I think the figure is like 175% of Medicare.
Medicaid does.
But the base rate, for Medicare nationally is increased by 25% for Alaska.
So maybe I misheard you, but I thought you said previously that Medicare reimbursed at 175%.
125 of the national average. Again, we are certainly unique in
that's
that.
Medicaid, though.
Medicare.
Okay.
No, you're absolutely right that in the lower 48, generally Medicare is considered a pretty good payer, and Medicaid is considered a poorer payer, to use a general term. And here in Alaska, it's the other way around. But it's not because Medicare rates are lower here. It's because Medicare rates relative to everything else are lower. The absolute level of payment for Medicare is higher here. And I think it's here in Hawaii, isn't it?
Okay, thank you for clarifying that. And then I just also wanted to say, you're talking a lot about fee-for-service as being the primary problem. And you know, it is a big problem. I think the incentivizing piece is a big problem. But I also feel like in some ways it's a little bit of a red herring. Like there's so much low-hanging fruit, right? You talked about innovation earlier. And you know, currently one of the big arguments for against a single-payer system is like, well, what happens when you start negotiating with the drug companies? They won't be able to create these awesome new drugs anymore. Right now they're not anyways. Most of the R&D is done, it's federally funded through the NIH. And so I think there's just like this control, these cost controls at the level of these really unbelievably expensive cancer drugs or all of these mimic drugs on the market, right, that are being reimbursed at really high cost and aren't necessarily, don't make up for the weight of their cost and their value. So yes, fee for service, but then there's also so many other aspects of this puzzle that we need to solve, and I feel like a single payer system is the way to do it. And as far as the political feasibility, that's us, right? We are the political feasibility. We need to create that change. If we make it loud enough that we're going to have a single payer system in Alaska, we could do it.
Question from the audience: where would insurance companies go if there was a single payer system in Alaska? What happens to insurance companies in that situation?
For the most part away, I would guess there'd still be some that would buy insurance to buy in, buy up, but for the most part it would be premium plans.
You would buy up your insurance. So you even have it right now that there's clinics that don't accept insurance and you have to pay, say, $100 a month for them to care for you. Instead of waiting, you know, maybe 3 weeks, 4 weeks, 6 months, 12 months, you would pay to be seen tomorrow because there'd be doctors that would not buy into this single payer system. So you still have insurance on top of the single payer system.
So actually in the Sanders plan, you would not be able to provide, like there would not be premium insurance. So you would not be able to buy insurance to get care that is covered by the single payer plan. So you could still get insurance that would cover things like plastic surgery and the things that aren't necessarily considered these core benefits. So the insurance companies would, I think they would probably still do fine, but they would not have a role in health insurance in the way that they do now.
It's a pretty big industry to go away.
Yeah, it is.
Here's a question again from the audience. Because of Alaska's high health care prices, without extreme federal government subsidies, would a state-based single-payer system cost more than the status quo than it is now? Does that make sense to everybody? Since our healthcare costs are very high and we lose federal subsidies in a single payer system, wouldn't the single payer system end up costing us more in the long run? It's a question as I understand it.
Well, I mean, as I mentioned, the people who studied the HCA for the state said specifically with regard to Medicaid, if you go to a unified system, you had to be careful not to do that. Not that you couldn't do it, but that you had to be careful about preserving the federal systems. In the case of systems like Medicaid, it's fairly straightforward. You would need to get a waiver to include that in the system. And some states have gotten that waiver, by the way, so it's not impossible to get a waiver to include them, but it's also not trivial.
Most industrial countries have better health care outcomes than the U.S. at much lower cost. Has anyone in Alaska looked at what makes other countries more successful and what it would take to import any of these ideas here? Seems like we're talking about that, but what I'm hearing is politically it's not viable yet.
So I guess I just want to, you know, I spend a lot of time in these healthcare conversations, but I feel like we get like distracted from the whole point. Sometimes I think we get into this like I have to pay less and I'm going to cost more, I'm going to shift here and how many pools can get there. And I think like we lose the fact that there's like patients in the middle of this and that we're losing the fact that there's a ton of low-hanging fruit. We're paying a ton of money. And I think that we in Alaska don't have to replicate the lower 48. I don't think that we have to do it like they've done. We don't have to do it. We only have 700,000 people. We are the people of the state. And I think if we all really become in the room together, we can come up with a solution that's better than they did in the lower 48. We can cut, and it doesn't have to be one model or another, but I get frustrated that we all pin one person or another. We create villains rather than creating systems of change. And I feel like we need to keep coming back to that. You know, I always tell my kids, like, you can't climb this mountain by thinking about how far away it is at the top. You can't eat an elephant one bite. You have to eat an elephant one bite at a time. And they hate me for it because I get them up the mountain. But, you know, I think it's the same way with this healthcare discussion. Like, we can talk about the top of the mountain and what that looks like. And I think it's great to have goals of where we're going to go to. And I think the goals are for healthy people that doesn't break the bank. Like, that's our basic goal. And how can we take that one step at a time where we're all in the same room together? We're not excluding providers from these conversations. We're not dropping bills that were not discussed with anyone who's actually providing health care. And we have a conversation with each other and come up with a better system. Sorry.
Yes. I guess just one thing, I'm trying to think how you would answer the question that was asked. I mean, in some ways, maybe the math isn't super complicated. You know, if you took our state population and you maybe took out our tribal members, and then you took the remainder, maybe you take out our military, you took the remainder and you multiplied it by maybe the retiree cost of care per enrollee, because I'm pretty sure they're satisfied with their care. And what is that number? And I guess I want to point out, when Ralph was sharing the numbers, I always think it's really amazing that Medicaid's cost per enrollee is the lowest of this group. So it's $10,414 a year. And granted, they set their prices, so that really helps. But if you're on Medicaid, you get awesome benefits. I mean, you get behavioral health care. You get a really good set of care. You
know, I don't know about the behavioral health care in
covered.
Medicaid.
It's covered. It is covered.
If there is a psychiatrist on
no.
the staff,
I get that
it may be covered,
underpaid.
But you can't
I know all
get
the
people there.
Me. Yeah, no, I get that we've underpaid it, but it's part of your benefit plan. That's what I'm saying. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that's included in for Medicaid enrollees that isn't,
yeah,
it's not part of my health
If it was
plan.
Really working well, we wouldn't have any trouble
it's
getting
not
people
working
in.
Perfectly. I get that. I get that. But I just want to point out that I think it is possible to provide a pretty robust set of services. Okay, take the retirees then, $12,000. That's only $2,000 difference. And people are happy with that care. So, yeah. I mean, that's the math we need to do. And then we need to say, okay, how do we pay for that? And is it, what are we paying for now? I mean, that's the problem in Alaska. It's like, we're so used to these huge amounts of money that we spend on things that we're just like, yeah, you know. I mean, we just kind of keep doing it. And we're just not in that world anymore. So we have to switch how we think about these issues.
Somebody was just asking for some information, and perhaps one of you all can give it. He or she wants to know how I can access demographic information about chronic health care costs. For example, you know, what are the demographics of certain chronic and acute conditions? What are the demographics of the treatments, number of treatments, and cost, and then administrative cost for those? Anybody know where you can ask somebody can simply get some numbers like that?
The state of Alaska does have a database, and you can request, usually a fee involved, to get the data that would describe it by DRG, by codes, and by area. That information is available. It's just kind of hard to ferret through.
Yeah, I mean, there is a large federal database, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, that has large research databases that have been used. Is it Kaiser Permanente that has the website that abstracts much of that data and presents it? Is that
it
the
is.
Right
so
website?
So that's what I was going to say. I think from a layperson standpoint, Kaiser Permanente's website is the best place to, like, you can enter all sorts of information, and it will graph it for you, and you can look at different geographics. So that's where I go a lot.
Let me see. Maybe one or two more questions. If there was some sort of single-payer health insurance, then wouldn't everybody be required to have health insurance like they're required to have automobile insurance?
Like today?
Well, not anymore.
Well, I mean, but that's what I find amazing as we talk about universal health care. In theory, we should have it right now. Everyone should have health care some way, either by a government payer or a private payer.
So in a single payer system, it wouldn't be a matter of you being required to have insurance, you would just have it.
Whether you wanted it or not.
Whether you wanted it or not. You would just show up at the doctor, you'd have your little card if you needed it. If you didn't use it, it wouldn't matter. You would still have it when you did.
Here's a question that when I really began to seriously think about health insurance, I always wondered how people would ask this, and it's very straightforward, and it seemed like it's very funny. Is it correct that all of us have a right to health care?
Not right now.
See, I don't think we even come to any conclusions on that issue?
We don't have one right now.
Well, you do by de facto of the emergency department, so.
Yeah, actually the question here says non-emergency health care, because that, by federal law. But I didn't say that.
That doesn't matter, you go to non-emergency in the emergency room anyway.
Yeah, right, no, absolutely.
60% of our patients are non-emergent, so
yeah. I think it becomes my UTI is very emergent.
I think it becomes hard when moral judgments on what is a right and what is not a right. And I think the question then becomes, what do we want as a country and what do we want as a society? Do we want healthy people? Like, do we want productive members of society who aren't struggling with mental illness and so they can't go to work and hold a job? Like, what do we want? So I don't think, I get frustrated with the question, like, is this a right? Because then it places a moral judgment on it. And I think that we want a country that succeeds, right? We want healthy people who go to work and take care of each other and care for their family members and don't have to pay a huge amount for their, you know, basic daily expenses. We want to have innovators who will come up with great new cures, and we want to go to the moon, and we want to do all these great things, but we need healthy people to do it. So for me, if we want a country to move forward, we need healthy people to be a part of that.
And healthy people are cheaper. That's the wonderful thing, is that when you're healthy, you're actually not consuming that much in terms of care, expensive care. So there's this wonderful alliance between what's good for people and what actually is better financially. And that's something that I think we have to always remind ourselves of.
And I would third that, not second it, third it. To say, I feel like the question, is healthcare a human right, is just one of those statements that polarizes people. And people close their ears and they stop listening because they know what camp they sit in. And I think it's really important to constantly bring yourself back to that point of, like, what is your goal? And, like, I like to think about it more of, like, you know, like, I feel, like, is it a right that we have clean water to drink, that the water's not going to make us sick? Is it a right to be able to walk down the street and feel at least mildly safe, you know? and like, what do we want as far as our community? So that's the way I look at it.
All right, I'll ask the questions one more time. Everybody in favor of a single payer system?
Ew.
Wow.
Everybody opposed? Okay, here comes the question. How many change their minds tonight?
Wow,
all right.
thank you so much, Dr. Woodard. Big hand for Dr. Woodard, a big hand for our panelists.
You have me at hello, Jennifer.
And a big hand for our members and volunteers, and a big hand for you. If you like these events, I got some suggestions for you. One, you could look at our Facebook page and get involved in the Facebook conversations. Number two, you could join our organization. And there's still a front desk, a front table where you could do that. If you do that, I promise you'll get emails about our future events. So our future events will include events on our fiscal challenge, for our state of Alaska, which, despite all our efforts, has not been fixed. And additionally, we're going to have we're also going to have some events on housing here in Alaska, another critical issue. So thank you very much. I appreciate you coming out, all the best to you. Could come up and try to get some more answers if you want to try. Thanks, folks, and good night.